6. Manchir Cathedral, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant. Sir Corin Garvey stood as the organ prelude soared like the wings of the archangels themselves, and the vast doors of Manchir Cathedral swung open. The procession started up the aisle behind the scepter-bearer and the thurifer. Ropes of sweet-smelling smoke trailed the jeweled thurible as it swung on its golden chain, and the thurifer was followed by a half-dozen candle-bearers, then a solid phalanx of acolytes and underpriests. Behind that, however, came the true reason the cathedral was so densely packed on this particular Wednesday. Archbishop Michael Stainer, primate of the Church of Carus, followed those acolytes, those underpriests. As the cathedral choir's massed voices rose in glorious song, those close enough to the archbishop could see his lips moving as he sang along with them. The rubies of his crown glittered like fresh hearts of blood in the morning sunlight, spilling through the cathedral's stained glass, and he was a full head taller than Clermont Gerling, who walked at his side. They paced steadily through the tumultuous waves of music and voices, and Garvey wondered how hard it was to do that. Despite the serenity of the archbishop's expression, the memory of the temple loyalists who'd attempted to assassinate him in his own cathedral had to be floating about in his mind, especially in light of what had happened to Timon Hoskins. If it was, there was no sign of it in Stainer's demeanor, and Garvey discovered he wasn't really surprised by that. His lips twitched as he remembered Stainer's initial meeting with his own father and the rest of the Regency Council, minus Earl Craggy Hill, who'd been rather conveniently, in Garvey's opinion, recalled to Valena by some purely local affair. Although he supposed it was undutiful of him, Garvey had decided his father's attitude towards the archbishop had been remarkably similar to a stiff-legged hunting hound, whose keen sense of smell suggested he was about to come face to face with a slash lizard. Tartarian had been less overtly stiff, though even his manner had been more than a bit wary, and the rest of the Regency Council's reactions had ranged downward from there. Yet there was something about Michael Stainer. Sir Corin Garvey couldn't put a label on that something, but whatever it was potent stuff. It was less what the archbishop had said than how he'd said it, Garvey decided. He'd obviously simply decided to assume the members of the council were men of goodwill, that despite the fact of Caleb's, and for that matter his own, excommunication, they'd given their oaths in good faith, that he understood their first concern must be the welfare of the Coruscantians who looked to them for protection, that he took it for granted that when men of goodwill recognized a problem, they would seek its solution. And it had been equally evident that if there was a single intolerant, bigoted, zealotry-ridden bone anywhere in his entire body, he was a wizard at concealing it. That's his real secret weapon, Garvey thought now. He genuinely is a man of God. I don't think there's an ounce of weakness anywhere in him, yet it's obvious, to me at least, that it's gentleness that drives him. Outraged gentleness, perhaps, but still gentleness. No one can spend 20 minutes in his presence without realizing that. He may be wrong, but there's no question that he's motivated by genuine love for God and his fellow man. And what makes that secret weapon so effective is that it's not a weapon at all. It's simply the way he is. Of course, there's also... The general's eyes drifted upward to the royal box. As in every cathedral, it was close enough to the sanctuary to be certain its occupants saw and heard everything clearly. With Prince Divan and Princess Iris in exile in Delphirach, the box was rather conspicuously unoccupied, which only made the single imperial guardsman standing in front of its closed wicket gate even more noticeable. He wore the black armor and the black, gold, blue, and silver of the Carisian Empire, but what everyone seemed to notice about him first were those strange sapphire eyes, Unlike the vast majority of Coruscantians, Garvai had met Sajan Merlin Athrawus before. Indeed, every member of the Regency Council had met him, in passing at least, and the Earls of Anvil Rock and Tartarian had spent quite a bit of time in his company, since he'd been the only armsman Caleb had allowed to be present during the surrender negotiations. Sir Alec Arthur knew him even better in some ways, or knew the Sajan's handiwork better at any rate, since it was the only thing that had kept him alive at the Battle of Green Valley. But everyone in the entire princedom knew his reputation, knew he was the most deadly warrior in the entire world, and that he'd personally killed all three of the assassins who'd attacked Stainer in Telesburg Cathedral. So knowing he was there, alert eyes sweeping back and forth constantly over the packed cathedral, probably contributed at least a little bit to the Archbishop's serenity. The opening hymn carried Stainer and Gerling to the sanctuary, and Garvai settled back in his own pew once both archbishops had seated themselves in their waiting thrones and the congregation was free to sit as well. The service flowed smoothly. There'd been virtually no changes to the long-standing and much-beloved liturgy. Indeed, the only substantive change was the omission of the Pledge of Loyalty to the Grand Vicar as the head of God's Church on Safehold, which, Garvai suspected, probably struck the group of four as a very substantive change. But eventually, they reached the point for which every person in that cathedral had been waiting, and the enormous structure was hushed, so silent the faint sounds of Stainer's footsteps were clear and distinct as he crossed to the pulpit. He stood for a moment, gazing out across the cathedral, then traced the sign of the scepter over the enormous bound volume of the writ before he opened it. The sound of the turning pages whispered through the cathedral's listening silence, and when he cleared his throat gently, it seemed almost shockingly loud. "Today's scripture," he said, his deep voice carrying to every ear, "is taken from the Book of Chihiro, chapter 9, verses 11 through 14. Then said the Lord to the Archangel Langhorn, 'Behold, I have created my holy church to be the mother of all men and women on the face of this world I have made. See to it that she nurtures all of my children, that she teaches the young, supports the footsteps and wisdom of those who are grown, cares for the elderly, and above all, that she trains up all of my children in the way they should go. Find men worthy of this great charge among my priests. Instruct them in all of their duties. Examine them and measure their souls. Weigh them in the scales of my balance. Fire them in the furnace of my discipline. Hammer them upon the anvil of my love. And when you have done these things, when you are confident that these are the priests fit to lead and feed my sheep, set them in places of authority. Give them that which they need to do my will, and remind them, and the priests who will come after them, and all the priests who shall follow them, that their purpose and their charge and their duty is to do my will, and always and everywhere, in every way, to serve my people.' And the Archangel Langhorn listened to all of these instructions from the Most High and Holiest, and the Archangel bowed his face to the earth. And he said unto the Lord his God, 'Truly, it shall be as you have commanded.'" The archbishop laid his hand on the opened book, looking out across the cathedral. "This is the word of God, for the children of God," he told them. "Thanks be to God and to the archangels who are his servants," the congregation replied, and there was an edge of tension in that response. A sort of breathless wonder as to how Stainer proposed to address those verses. "Be seated, my children," he invited, and feet scraped and clothing rustled in a great sighing murmur as they obeyed him. He waited the better part of another full minute, hands clasped lightly on the writ. He gazed out at them, his eyes sweeping the entire cathedral, letting them see his examination and giving them time to examine him in turn. There was no sign of any notes, not even a single note card, and he smiled. It was a thing of wonder, that smile. Gentle and warm, welcoming, and, above all, real. It was no actor's train smile. It came from somewhere deep inside the man, and Garvey felt an odd little stir, more sensed than heard, sweep through the cathedral as the worshippers saw it. "I picked today's scripture deliberately," he told them then. "But I bet most of you had already figured that out," he added, with a perfect sense of timing, and somehow that smile had turned impish. A soft mutter of laughter, laughter which had surprised itself, gusted through the cathedral, and his smile grew even more dazzling for a moment. "Of course I selected it deliberately." His smile faded, and his voice turned serious, dropping a bit lower, so that they had to listen just a bit harder. "All of you have heard that passage time and time again. In fact, it has a name, doesn't it? The Great Charge, we call it. And we call it that because that was what the archangels called it, and because it is the Great Charge. This passage, this scripture, is the fundamental basis of Mother Church, God's own warrant for her creation and birth. His instruction to Holy Langhorne contains not only his command for Mother Church's creation, but also the description of her duties. The end, the purpose, for which he ordained her creation. It tells us what she is supposed to do in simple, straightforward words." He paused, allowing his own words to settle into his listeners' minds and thoughts, then continued. "Of course, simple and straightforward isn't the same as easy. No great task, however straightforward, is ever easy. And what task could be greater than the one God Himself assigned to Mother Church? And what other institution of this world could command the devotion, the respect, and the love of God's children more strongly than His own Church? We are enjoined again and again, over and over, in every book of the Holy Writ, to love God, to keep His laws, to do His will, to live in fulfillment of His plan, and to honor and obey His Church." The stillness in the cathedral had grown tighter, more focused, and he smiled again, sadly, as if he felt that physical pressure bearing down upon him. "Of course, that's what he said," the schismatic archbishop told them all calmly. "There's no wiggle room in God's instructions on this matter, my children. No gray theological areas where scholars and theologians can argue and debate and pass the language. It's not a suggestion, not an invitation, not a proposal. It's a command. It's God's command, just as surely as He has commanded us to keep Wednesdays holy, or to love one another as much as we love ourselves." He shook his head. "And yet, the very fact that I stand here before you in this cathedral is proof the Church of Caris is not obeying the Church's decrees." His voice was hard now, not angry, not denouncing, not even challenging, but unflinching as a sword. "I have been excommunicated by the Grand Vicar," he continued, and tension ratcheted upward in the cathedral as he met that fact head on. "I have been stripped by him of my priestly status. I have been condemned in absentia for heresy, apostasy, and treason, and sentenced to suffer the punishment of Schuler for my manifold crimes and sins. The Church of Caris has risen in revolt against the decrees of the vicarate, of the Grand Inquisitor, of the Grand Vicar himself. We have rejected instructions from the temple. We have defrocked and hanged for murder priests acting in the Grand Inquisitor's name. We have created our own bishops and archbishops, ordained our own priests, and in every corner of the Empire of Caris we have defied Mother Church and dared her to do her worst. We have met her proxies in battle, and we have conquered other lands, even this princedom of Coruscant, by force of arms, in spite of Mother Church's declared will. And I tell you now, it is only a matter of time, and not a great deal of it, before Mother Church declares holy war against the Church of Charis, the Empire of Charis, and any human being, any child of God, who has been so lost to his obedience to Mother Church as to support her enemies. We did not come to you here bearing peace, my children, and I will not pretend we did. No, we come bearing a sword, and that sword is in our hand just as surely as defiance is in our hearts. The stillness was so intense now that Garvai was distantly astounded that it didn't shatter when he inhaled. Stainer let that stillness linger, let it roar in the worshipper's ears. He stood in the stained glass sunlight, wreathed in tendrils of incense, like a lump of stone at the bottom of a deep, cold well of silence. "Yes," he said at last, "we have rejected our obedience to Mother Church, despite God's own order. But there is a reason we've done that, my children. Despite anything you may have heard, the Kingdom of Charis and the Church within Charis did not declare war upon Mother Church." Feet and bodies stirred in protest, but he shook his head sharply, and the stirrings ceased. "Mother Church declared war upon us, my children. She decreed the destruction of Charis, and she used your prince and your navy and your husbands and fathers and sons and brothers to bring that destruction to pass. She launched her attack without warning or declaration. She did not remonstrate with us, never told us we had fallen into doctrinal error, never instructed us in what we might have done better, more obediently. She simply decreed our destruction, that we be broken and shattered and wiped from the record of Safehold's history, that our people be murdered in their own homes, and that those homes be burned above their heads. And so we defended ourselves, protected our homes, our families, from that destruction, and for that, we were pronounced heretics and excommunicate." He shook his head again, his expression grim. "And in the 13th verse of this morning's scripture, you will find our defense. The Lord said to Langhorne, 'When you are confident that these are the priests fit to lead and feed my sheep, set them in places of authority. Give them that which they need to do my will.' But he also said to Langhorne, 'Remind them, and the priests who will come after them, and all the priests who shall follow them, that their purpose and their charge and their duty is to do my will, and always and everywhere, in every way, to serve my people.' He instructed Langhorne that it was their charge, the very reason he had brought the vicarate into existence, to nurture and teach and guide and protect and serve his people. There is no, can be no, calling higher than that one, no deeper obligation, no more solemn duty. But Mother Church failed that obligation, ignored that duty. Mother Church, my children, is governed by men. They are enjoined to govern her in accordance with God's will, but they are still men. And the men who currently control Mother Church, who have turned the Grand Vicar himself into their puppet and mouthpiece, men like Alain Maguire, Robert Duquesne, Zomson Trenaire, and above all, Jaspar Clinton, are as corrupt and venal and evil and foul as any men who ever walked God's world." The gentle Archbishop's voice was the very sword he'd told them the Church of Charis had brought to Coruscant, and it was as keen-edged and as merciless as any blade ever forged. "It is our duty to obey Mother Church. But it is also our duty to recognize when the orders we are given come not from Mother Church, not from the archangels, and never from God himself, but from corrupt power-mongers, from men who have chosen to turn God's holy church into a prostitute, who sell the power of their high offices, who sell Mother Church herself, who decree the murders of entire kingdoms, who use the power of the Inquisition to terrify any thought of opposition to their corruption, who have Mother Church's own priests tortured to death on the very steps of the temple for failing to be corrupt enough. God's instruction to obey Mother Church is as simple and straightforward as the words of this morning's scripture. But so is his great charge to the priesthood of Mother Church, to the men called to wear the orange of vicars, to the Grand Vicar and the Grand Inquisitor. And those men in Zion have failed his charge. That last measured sentence rang in his listeners' ears like an iron gauntlet, hitting a stone floor in challenge. Obedience to instructions to commit sin becomes complicity in sin, no matter the source of those instructions. Schuller tells us that in his book, no matter the source, those are the Archangel Schuller's very words, my children. I know you've heard temple loyalists here in Manchir quoting that passage. And the Church of Chorus will not tell them to be silent, will not seek to dictate to their souls. But the Church of Chorus believes we cannot give godly obedience to sinful men claiming to speak in his most holy name when they have long since forfeited that claim by their own actions. He drew himself up to his full height, facing the packed pews of Manchir Cathedral. "We cannot, we have not, and we will not," he said. "We dictate to no man or woman's conscience. We will not compel. We will not torture and kill those who simply disagree with us, but neither will we yield. Let it be known throughout Coruscant that any who wish to join us in our effort to reclaim Mother Church's soul from the corrupt men who have defiled it will be welcome. That we will greet you as our brothers and our sisters and our fellow children of God, and that we will go forward to the end of this great task to which we have been called. We will not falter, we will not be swayed, and we will never, ever surrender. Let Clintan and Trenair and their flunkies be warned. In the fullness of time, the Church of Chorus will come for them. Come for them in that day when it comes to Mother Church's rescue and liberates her from the servants of the dark who have profaned her for far too long." 7. Crag House, City of Valena, Earldom of Craggy Hill, Princedom of Coruscant. Bishop Executor Thomas Schiller looked up from his conversation with Maroc Holland as someone rapped sharply on the chamber door. Despite the fact that he knew, intellectually, that he was perfectly safe here in his Crag House office, a spasm of alarm flashed through him. There were no scheduled visitors or conferences this morning, and for a hunted fugitive, especially a fugitive bishop executor whose intendant had been impiously murdered, unexpected translated itself into threatening. "Oh, don't be silly, Thomas," he scolded himself. "I doubt armed minions of the Regency Council or the Church of Chorus could break this far into an earl's townhouse without at least some alarm preceding them. For that matter, I tend to doubt the present authorities would knock politely once they got this far. They didn't bother to knock on Adrian's door, at any rate." His face tightened briefly at the thought. Then he cleared his throat. "Enter," he called, and the Earl of Craggy Hill stepped through the door. "Good morning, my lord." Schiller heard the surprise in his own voice. "I didn't expect to see you this morning."
"I didn't expect to be here, Your Eminence."
Something in Craggy Hill's manner, something glittering in his brown eyes, brought Schiller a bit more upright in his chair. He glanced quickly at Holland, catching a glimpse of an echoing speculative curiosity in his secretary's expression then returned his full attention to Craggy Hill.
"May I ask what changed your plans then, my lord?" the bishop executor inquired, gesturing at the comfortable armchair before his desk as he spoke.
"You most certainly may, Your Eminence."
Craggy Hill flashed a brief, tight smile before he settled into the armchair. Holland started to rise, but the Earl waved him back into his own chair.
"Stay, father," the nobleman said. "I'm sure you and His Eminence will be preparing quite a bit of correspondence in the next few 5 days, so you might as well hear my news now."
"Of course, my lord," Holland murmured.
The secretary sat back down after glancing at his superior for confirmation, and Craggy Hill returned his full attention to Shillere.
"I realize the reports from Manchir have been fairly disappointing ever since Stainer arrived in the Princedom, Your Eminence," he said then,
which Shillere reflected was one of the best examples of understatement he'd heard in the last several years. Calling the semaphore summaries from Manchir fairly disappointing was about the same as calling Carter's Ocean fairly deep. It was obvious, however little the bishop executor cared to admit it, that not simply the city of Manchir, but the entire duchy was largely lost. Adrian's order for Hoskins' execution had backfired badly. Shillere was astounded that the fully justified death of a single apostate priest could have spawned such seething anger and outrage. It was as if the citizens of Manchir had deliberately chosen not to understand the depravity of Hoskins' attack upon Mother Church. As if they'd actually sympathized with him, simply because he was capable of occasional bursts of eloquence in the service of God's enemies. Yet it would have been foolish to underestimate the strength of that furious anger or the severity of its consequences. Stainer certainly hadn't. His very first sermon from the stolen pulpit of Manchir Cathedral had capitalized upon that anger, as he'd set forth his attempts to justify his own betrayal of Mother Church and the creation of the Church of Caris. Nothing could possibly justify such an abortion, yet angry minds were not reasonable ones, and Stainer's sermons had fallen upon fertile ground. Even many of those who continued to bitterly resent the Empire of Caris were weakening in their opposition to the Church of Caris. For that matter, any residual anger in the capital over the fashion in which Adrian Wyman and the other slain priests had been martyred was increasingly directed towards the secular authorities rather than Stainer or Gerling. Any idiot ought to recognize that neither the Regency Council nor Viceroy General Sherman would have dared act in such a fashion except at the direct orders of the church to which they had given their allegiance. Yet a dangerous degree of separation between the Carisian Church and the Carisian Crown had crept into the minds of all too many, and Stainer's other sermons, with their emphasis on freedom of conscience, their renunciation of the question and the punishment of Schuller, their specific guarantees that temple loyalists who abided by the law might continue to worship using the liturgy and even the priests they chose, had won him still more support. Even worse, perhaps, it was winning him toleration, even among those who thought they were remaining loyal to Mother Church. There were reports that even many of the temple loyalists had come to respect him, even if grudgingly, for his integrity. That erosion of faith was what most worried Shillere, yet he knew his secular allies, like Craggy Hill, were just as worried by the fact that despite the separation some still drew between empire and church, the acceptance of the Church of Caris was slowly but steadily eroding resistance to the Empire as well. Primary loyalty to Prince Divan clearly remained high. Many Coruscandians continued to distinguish between their exiled prince and the Regency Council acting in his name, and the people of Coruscant were a long, long way from forgiving Caleb for Prince Hector's murder. Yet there was a vast difference between rejecting the current regime's legitimacy and actively resisting it. That was where the overflow of the creeping acceptance of the Church of Carus was gradually eating away at the foundations of the resistance's secular support. And just to make things worse, the capital's population seemed to have come to the conclusion that the resistance, their liberators, were the true enemy. Intellectually, Schiller could grasp the crude physical factors involved in that process, yet he was constitutionally incapable of truly sympathizing with anyone who could entertain such a bizarre notion. It involved such a profound rejection of God's will in favor of such purely selfish, material considerations of this world that he literally could not understand it. Yet whether he could understand it or not, he'd still been forced to admit its existence and factor it into his own increasingly depressing thinking. Under Carizian protection, trade was beginning to flourish once more in southeastern Coruscant. Goods were flooding the ports, businesses were open. Prince Hector's tariffs and import duties, many of which had been heavily increased as he prepared to resist the Carizian invasion, had been slashed, and Carizian investors were clearly on the lookout for opportunities. The capital's economy had not yet recovered to pre-invasion levels, but it was approaching them quickly, and at a rate which suggested it would soon exceed them. At the same time, the devastating blow Garvey had dealt to Wyman's organization had brought all coordinated, centrally managed resistance to an end. A handful of his people might have escaped, but they were too scattered, driven too deeply into hiding to accomplish much. That had brought the spontaneous incidents Wyman had been carefully nursing to a sudden, knee-buckling halt. What was left were far more often than not outbreaks of pure thuggery, however little Schiller liked admitting that. They were no longer carefully targeted. Indeed, they were so poorly targeted, they were virtually random, almost as likely to inflict damage on temple loyalists as on the traitors. That was turning a steady trickle of those temple loyalists against the people responsible for their own losses. And those responsible for it were also being dealt with ruthlessly by the authorities. Which meant those attempting to resist the occupation were increasingly seen as the source of violence and destruction, while those supporting the occupation were seen as the citizenry's protection from acts of violence. It would have taken a bedardist to explain that chain of logic to Schiller. Surely anyone ought to be able to understand that it was the occupier's presence which was provoking the violent response. That being the case, what twisted chain of reasoning could possibly give them credit for suppressing the violence rather than assigning them the blame for having caused it in the first place? Yet however bizarre he might find the thought, he couldn't deny that it was happening. And even more discouragingly, the Regency Council was actually garnering an increasing degree of respect, even among the capital's temple loyalists, for its restraint. No one was simply being arrested and tossed into prison just in case. Garvey's guardsmen weren't particularly gentle with those who resisted arrest, but anyone who was arrested was also charged, and no one who'd been charged was punished without a trial. And while they were in prison awaiting trial, they were permitted access to temple loyalist clergy and to family members, which just happened to knock any rumors about prisoners being secretly tortured neatly on the head. There'd been quite a few executions, and everyone in Manchir knew there were going to be more, but the Regency Council had been scrupulous about maintaining at least the semblance of justice. It had become depressingly clear that there would be no general uprising, not on the scale they needed, in the southeast. There would still be some support, some knots of resistance, and it was probable a substantial portion of the people would exhibit at least passive resistance when the moment came. But none of that could disguise the fact that when they finally launched their own uprising, beginning here in the north, they would be initiating not a general insurrection, but a civil war right here in Coruscant, between those willing to lick the Carizian hand and those still loyal to Mother Church and Prince Divan.
And every day only tilts the odds a little more against us,
Shalaire thought bitterly.
Anvil Rock and Tartarian are already moving to expand their tidy little citadel down there in the southeast, and from the sounds of things, Baron Blackcliff is about to sign his soul away and publicly support them.
He shook free of his depressing reflections and nodded to Craggy Hill.
I think disappointing would be one way to describe those reports, my lord, yes, he said dryly.
Well, I have a bit of news which is considerably more encouraging, I think, the Earl told him. It doesn't have anything to do with anything going on down there in the south, I'm afraid. But Zebediah has finally stopped dancing around.
He has?
Shalaire sat up straighter, expression suddenly intent, and Craggy Hill smiled. It was not, the prelate thought, an especially pleasant expression.
Oh, he has, Your Eminence. In fact, I think the dance may have come to more of a complete halt than he realizes.
In what way?
He's been very careful to communicate only verbally, by way of personal representatives he trusts, Craggy Hill said. Oh, I've been in correspondence with him, but none of our letters have contained anything incriminating. We've both had excellent reasons to avoid that.
The Earl grimaced, and Shalaire snorted. Treachery came as naturally as breathing to Thomas Simmons, Grand Duke of Zebediah. If Craggy Hill had been so incautious as to include any open reference to treason in a letter to Zebediah, the Grand Duke would have sold it to Caleb and Charlian the moment it offered him any advantage.
But, the Earl continued, he's finally committed to a definite schedule for supplying us with the new rifled muskets. And he said as much in writing.
You're joking.
Oh, no. Craggy Hill's smile was thinner than ever. Of course, he didn't realize he was committing that to me. His correspondence to me is still the very soul of discretion. But he's had to be a bit more frank in his instructions to those envoys of his. I've been aware of that for some time, and I'm afraid his current envoy was brutally set upon and robbed last night.
The Earl clasped his hands in front of him and raised his eyes piously towards heaven for a moment.
Obviously, I'm investigating, and the envoy, who suffered only minor injuries and the loss of all his jewels and money, is torn between mentioning the fact that his stolen money belt contained his most recent instructions, and hoping to shun way we never catch up with the thieves in question.
You think he truly doesn't realize you already have it, which you clearly do, my lord?
Shalaire asked, his eyes narrowing.
Oh, he has to recognize it as a possibility, Your Eminence, but it was a very convincing robbery, if I do say so myself. And the thieves were clearly planning to cut his throat to make sure there were no witnesses when he managed to escape, which should make him at least a little doubtful about my involvement. He knows I have to know that if I'd had him killed, Zebediah would instantly have smelled a spider rat and backed away. What he doesn't know is that I knew, or rather strongly suspected, he had those instructions on his person. I don't think he realized my agents had been able to identify the factor here in Valena who's been passing Zebediah's mail back and forth. So he doesn't know the thieves followed from picking up his latest dispatch. As a matter of fact, I'm not positive he'd had time to read it himself, although from some of the things he said, it's pretty evident he's at least generally aware of its contents. Given all that, there's got to be a huge question mark in his mind where the possibility of my involvement is concerned, but he can't be certain either way. So he's probably hoping it really was thieves who'll be interested only in his money and jewels and simply throw the correspondence away, or failing that, that they'll be bright enough to realize just how dangerous it is and burn it before it can get them killed. The last thing he wants is for my guardsmen to lay the thieves by the heels, find Zebediah's letter to him, and hand it over to me. But the critical point is that even if Zebediah thinks I arranged it, even if he decides he wants to back away, he can't now. I have a letter in his own hand, telling his envoy to tell our friends in Coruscant he's prepared to supply weapons for the purpose of resisting the Carizian occupation. Specifically, with rifled muskets diverted from the Imperial Army in Chisholm. Neither I nor anyone else in Coruscant is identified in the letter, but his intentions are spelled out quite clearly over his own signature. The Bishop Executor decided he could easily have shaved with Craggy Hill's smile, and he felt himself smiling back.
"That letter's going into my personal strongbox, Your Eminence," the Earl said in a tone of intense satisfaction. "And if Zebediah should happen to prove difficult, I can always gently inform him that I have it. And, of course, that should he continue to prove difficult, it just might find its way into Garvey's or Cherman's hands."
Shalea leaned back in his chair once more, and his smile faded into a more sober expression of gratitude.
"Thank you, God," he thought. "Forgive me for having doubted, for having permitted myself to feel despair. The writ says you will deliver your enemies to justice, using even the hand of the ungodly themselves. I can scarcely pretend the Grand Duke is a godly man, but you've given him into our hands, and in the end we will use that to bring your enemies to justice."
He closed his eyes briefly as he made that promise, but even if he'd kept them open, he would never have noticed the tiny remote perched upon his ceiling, which had just transmitted every word of his conversation with Craggy Hill to a far-distant artificial intelligence named Owl. May, Year of God, 894. 1. HMS Chihiro, 50, Garath Bay, Kingdom of Dolar.
"Excuse me, my lord, but I think you'd better see this."
The Earl of Thirsk turned from Chihiro's stern windows and his contemplation of the ships of his slowly growing fleet. The commander, who'd just entered his day cabin, was about 30, with brown eyes, a dark complexion and dark hair, and a particularly luxurious mustache.
"And what, precisely, might this be, Alvin?" Thirsk asked mildly.
"Sorry, my lord." Commander Alvin Kapar smiled wryly. "It's a dispatch from the governor of Quiroz. It was marked urgent, so the semaphore station sent it over immediately instead of waiting for the regular afternoon boat."
"The governor of Quiroz?"
Thirsk frowned. He could think of a handful of reasons the governor of a province of the Harchong Empire might be sending him an urgent dispatch. There was only one that seemed particularly likely, however, and he felt his nerves tightening.
"Very well, Alvin."
The Earl extended his hand, and Kapar handed him the heavy envelope. Then the commander bowed slightly and withdrew from the admiral's cabin. Thirsk watched him go with a smile. One of these days, Alvin Kapar was going to make a very fine galleon captain. At the moment, however, he was busy creating a position which was something entirely new in the Royal Dolaran Navy. Thirsk hadn't yet come up with a term for that something new, but back on a planet called Old Earth, it would have been Chief of Staff. One of the things the Earl had realized was that he needed a group of assistants to help him handle the immense task of rebuilding the Navy, which had been destroyed off Armageddon Reef. Kapar was one of those assistants, and very good he was at his job, too.
"Almost as good as he is at inveigling young ladies into spending copious quantities of time in his own charming company."
Thirsk shook his head.
"That young man is going to go far, assuming he manages to avoid getting himself killed in a duel somewhere."
He put that thought aside and opened the envelope. He scanned its contents quickly, and his smile vanished. He refolded the single sheet of paper and turned back to the windows, gazing out across the bay, but his unfocused eyes didn't really see it now. They were looking at mental images of remembered charts while his mind whirred.
He stayed that way for several minutes, then gave himself a shake, walked across to the cabin door, and poked his head out.
My lord?
The sentry stationed there, he was an army corporal detailed to naval service. Thirsk was still trying to get Thorast to agree to form a dedicated marine corps like the Carizian Marines. Asked, coming to attention quickly.
Pass the word for Lieutenant Bardilon and Master Vanwick to report to me immediately, please, Thirsk instructed.
At once, my lord.
Thirsk nodded and turned back into the cabin while he heard the message being passed. He was looking out the stern windows again when Martin Vanwick and Abel Bardilon arrived.
You sent for us, my lord, the flag lieutenant said. Indeed I did, Abel.
Thirsk gazed out across the bay for a moment longer, then swung to face them.
We need to send some messages, he said crisply. We'll need letters to Duke Fern and Duke Thorast, Martin, with copies to Bishop Stiefen and Admiral Holland for their information.
At once, my lord.
The secretary crossed to a side table, set up as a writing desk, pulled a sheet of paper towards him, and dipped a pen.
I'm ready, my lord.
Good.
Thirsk smiled in approval, then glanced at Bardilon.
Once we've gotten the letters off, I'll also want you to collect Commander Kapar and the others and Captain Bycett for an immediate meeting here, Abel.
The Earl pointed at the carpet under his feet, and the flag lieutenant nodded.
I'll see to it, my lord.
Good,
Thirsk repeated. Then he inhaled deeply, turned back to Vanwick, and began to dictate.
My knights... Put in all the proper salutations, Martin. I have the duty to inform you that I have received a dispatch from the governor of Quiraz informing me that an imperial dispatch boat has sighted Carizian warships and transports passing through the Straits of Quiraz on a northerly heading. The governor states in his message that he has high confidence in the officer making the report, but that it was impossible for him to obtain a definite count before he was forced to withdraw to evade pursuit by a Carizian schooner. The schooner in question was positively identified as a cruiser of the Imperial Carizian Navy, and not a privateer vessel. Underline both positively and not, Martin.
Of course, my lord.
If the secretary was dismayed by the letter's content, his voice showed no sign of it. And Thirsk smiled approvingly at the crown of his bent head before he resumed. The Ha-Chong-Gi's dispatch boat captain reports that he counted a minimum of 8 Carizian war galleons and what appeared to be at least that many transport or cargo vessels. It would seem unlikely that Imperial Carizian warships have been dispatched this far afield as mere convoy escorts. I believe, therefore, that we must assume the merchant galleons he cited are in fact transports, and that this represents an operation directed against us here in Dolar, or against the Ha-Chong Empire. Given the more advanced state of our naval preparations, I feel this kingdom is the more probable target, although the possibility of operations against both realms clearly cannot be ruled out. The presence of transports suggests to me that the Carizian intention is to seize a suitable base somewhere in the Sea of Ha-Chong or in the Dolaran Gulf proper. Obviously, at this point, we cannot possibly say which of those possibilities is their actual intention, but I am inclined to believe their most probable destination is Claw Island. It is virtually uninhabited. It is far enough from our own naval bases or those of the Empire to discourage any hasty counterattack upon it, and it would be well placed to threaten the coasts of Quiraz, Kuznetsov, Teagle Camp, Steen, and even Shui Bay, in addition to interfering with our own commerce and shipping in the Gulf of Dolar. The actual distance from Claw Island to Garath is, of course, in excess of 4,000 miles, but I believe it is entirely possible that having secured and fortified Claw Island, an audacious Carizian commander might well seize an unfortified anchorage much closer to us, purely as a forward operating base. I have pointed out in the past the desirability of fortifying the islands of the Dolar Bank chain. That was going to piss off Thorast, who'd rejected his recommendations in that respect, Thirsk thought, but it still had to be said. As things now stand, I cannot guarantee the Navy's ability to prevent a sufficiently powerful Carizian squadron from seizing such an anchorage on Trove Island or any one of the trios. It will obviously be some time before any warships as far distant as the Straits of Quiroz can pose any threat in home waters. I believe, however, that it behooves us to be as beforehand as possible in dealing with this incursion. I therefore humbly request that we immediately consult with the Harchong ambassador about the possible coordination of our efforts in this regard. In the meantime, Bishop Stiefen and I will consult on how best we may prepare our own forces. I will report to you as soon as he, Admiral Holland, and I have completed our preliminary evaluation of our capabilities and how they might best be utilized in the face of the threat I anticipate. I have the honor to be, etc., etc., etc. The Earl looked back out the windows for a moment, thinking, then shrugged. Read that back, please, Martin.
Of course, my lord. The secretary cleared his throat. My knights, I have the duty to inform you that I have received...
2. HMS Dancer, 56, off Claw Island, Sea of Harchong. Sir Gwilym Manthier watched the schooner Messenger's topsails as she cleared the mouth of Snake Channel and altered course. He couldn't see her hull from here, but he could track the white flaw of her sails against the looming brown mountains of Claw Island, and he frowned as he contemplated them. His greatest concern over Hardship Bay's suitability as an anchorage was what an easterly wind would do to it. Even a schooner would have a terrible time trying to claw her way out against an east wind. Snake Channel, the bay's southern entrance, would be usable with the wind out of the northeast by east, and North Channel would be usable with the wind out of the southeast by east, but a galleon would have trouble making it out of either channel even under those conditions. At the moment, however, the wind, such as there was and what there was of it, was out of the south-southwest, and Messenger settled down on the starboard tack, with the wind almost broad on the beam, and headed for his flagship. All the rest of his command, 53 ships, lay hove to in Shell Sound, the broad body of water between Green Island and Hardship Shoal. It was oppressively hot, even by Carizian standards. He'd left his tunic in his cabin, yet sweat glued his shirt to his skin, and when he held his hand an inch or so above one of the black-painted quarterdeck carronades, the heat radiated back up against his palm as if from the top of a stove. The awnings rigged above the deck to give the crew some little shade helped, but in Manthier's opinion, it was basically the difference between being slowly baked in an oven or broiled over an open flame. He'd expected heat, but he hadn't been prepared for heat this hot, and the fact that the wind had dropped to no more than a gentle breeze didn't help. Nor was it going to speed Messenger to Dancer anytime soon. In this wind, even the fleet little schooner was doing well to make 2 or 3 knots with all sail set, and she had the better part of 15 miles to cover to reach the flagship. Manthier looked up at the sun and pursed his lips. Call it 5 hours, more likely 6, and it was already past 11. He grimaced and stepped back into the quarterdeck awning shade. It wasn't a particularly dense shade, but after the unfiltered, eye-searing sunlight beyond it, it felt like stepping into a cave. A very hot cave.
Donald, he said, turning his head and blinking as he looked for his flag lieutenant, before his eyes had really adjusted to the relative dimness.
Yes, sir? Lieutenant Donald Rosman responded from somewhere behind him, and he turned towards the voice.
Ah, there you are. The Admiral shook his head, smiling in wry sympathy. I was afraid you'd finally been rendered down.
Not quite yet, sir, Rosman returned his admiral smile, although, truth be told, Manthir's jest cut entirely too close to reality, in the lieutenant's opinion. Rosman was a Chisomian, one of the growing number of Chisomians being integrated into the Imperial Navy, with exotic, by Carizian standards, auburn hair and gray eyes, and a fair complexion that was perfectly happy to burn angry red, blister, or even peel painfully, but flatly refused to tan.
Well, there's time yet, I suppose, Manthir chuckled.
It wasn't that he didn't sympathize. It was simply that there wasn't anything either of them could do about it except laugh.
No, sir, Rosman agreed. In the meantime, though, was there something you needed me to do? As a matter of fact, yes.
Manthir waved in Messenger's direction.
I imagine it's going to take 5 or 6 hours for her to reach us. Under the circumstances, I thought we might move supper forward and invite Commander Grazael to join us this evening. It seems the least we can do after sending him all the way in to talk to these people.
Of course, sir. Do you wish Captain McGale to join you?
The Captain, Master Seasmoke, and Lieutenant Kruger. No, Kruger will have the watch, won't he?
Manthir thought for a moment, then shrugged.
Make it Lieutenant Waldair and young Sversman, and you, of course.
So 6 guests, including me, Rosman said, mentally counting up the names. I'll go and tell Nyklos, sir. The Flag Lieutenant smiled again, faintly.
He's still going to complain that we didn't give him enough notice, you realize.
Of course he is. It's what he does.
Manthir's answering smile held just a bit of resignation. Ryan Hallman, his servant of many years, had been killed at Darko Sound, and Manthir missed him badly. Not just because they'd been together for so long, although that was definitely part of it, but also because Hallman had suited him so well. Manthir's birth had been as common as even a future Carizian seaman's came, and Hallman had been a Howl Bay fisherman before he joined the Navy. Personally, Manthir suspected Ryan Hallman hadn't always been the man's name. There'd been any number of men like that in the Royal Carizian Navy, and that hadn't changed now that it was the Imperial Carizian Navy. As long as a man did his duty and didn't get into fresh trouble, the Navy was willing to overlook any indiscretions in his previous life. In Hallman's case, Manthir had observed that he never voluntarily went ashore in Telisburg. Whatever might have lurked in Hallman's past, young Lieutenant Manthir had always found him a reliable hand and a skilled coxswain. When Lieutenant Commander Manthir got his first command, he'd taken Hallman with him, first as his personal coxswain and then, later, as his cabin servant. Calling him a valet would have stretched a perfectly serviceable noun far beyond its acceptable limits. Still, he'd been loyal, tough, hard-working, and remarkably good with a cutlass, which had done perfectly well for Gwilym Manthir. Yet he was gone now, and Sir Gwilym Manthir had required a replacement. Enter Nyklos Valaine, who clearly considered Manthir a work in progress. The dapper, dark-haired valet was about 10 years older than Manthir, and he'd been highly recommended by Dominic Stainer.
"He'll fuss and fidget you to death," Stainer had said, "but he'll also manage to feed you hot soup in the middle of a howling gale. No matter how long you give him to prepare for a formal dinner, he'll swear it's not long enough, then come up with a 5-course meal and somehow conjure up fresh vegetables when you're stuck in the middle of the anvil. And to be honest, Gwilym, I think he's exactly what you're going to need now that you've got your streamer."
There hadn't been much doubt in Manthir's mind what Rockpoint had been getting at. Captains might not have to worry over much about appearances. Admirals did. And the unvarnished truth was that Manthir's life and career had made him a consummate professional as a seaman, but didn't seem to have gotten around to matters of etiquette, the proper choice of wines, or all those other little details admirals were supposed to know about.
Valaine was fixing that, and there were times Manthir felt a certain kinship with a white-hot piece of bar stock being hammered into a horseshoe. He was deeply grateful, but that didn't necessarily mean he enjoyed the process, and Valaine was just as persnickety, finicky, precise, and downright fussy as Rockpoint had warned him the man would be. Which, the Admiral reflected, watching his flag lieutenant head below, was why he'd sent Rosman to beard Valaine in his den. Rank, after all, had its privileges. In the end, they didn't have to move supper forward after all, much to Valaine's long-suffering, if unvoiced, disgust. The wind had continued to drop, falling to a complete calm, with Messenger still 2 miles short of the flagship, and Lieutenant Commander Grazale had covered the final distance in his quarterboat. At the moment, his oarsmen were enjoying a well-deserved rest in Dancer's Crew's mess, while Grazale apologized to his admiral for the delay. Like Rosman, Grazale was a Chisomian, although he was as dark-haired and eyed as any Carizian. He tanned better than Rosman, too, Manthir thought with a certain amusement, watching them stand almost side by side. In fact, Grazale had darkened to a deep coppery bronze, which, combined with his rather worn tunic, like most of the Navy's junior ship commanders, he didn't appear overly long in the purse, gave him a distinctly piratical look. Or rather, the look pirates were supposed to have, according to bad novels. Manthir had read a novel once. The fact that it had been about pirates might have been one reason he'd never read another. After all, he'd met real pirates, and anything less like the jolly, good-hearted but misunderstood characters in that particular literary abortion would have been difficult to imagine. He shook that thought aside and waved away Grazale's apologies.
"Don't worry about it, Commander. No one can issue orders to the wind. Well, not and have them obeyed, anyway. Frankly, you did well to get here this promptly. I understand from my valet, however."
He very carefully did not cock a wary eye in Niklos Valaine's direction.
"That supper is ready. I suggest we all sit down and eat before it spoils. We can discuss such minor things as reports after we have that safely out of the way."
The sniff of satisfaction he thought he heard from the direction of Valaine's pantry was probably only his imagination. Sometime later, when Valaine and the wardroom steward he'd pressed into service had cleared the table, poured the wine, and put Manthir's tobacco humidor in the center of the table, the Admiral leaned back in his chair with a sigh of content. The wind had picked back up a bit, and the canvas wind scoop rigged for the skylight funneled some of it through the dining cabin. It brought with it a welcome breath of coolness, blowing back out through the stern and quarter windows. Fussy as Valaine might be, he'd done his usual outstanding job, and two of the wyverns he'd acquired when the fleet paid a brief call at Westbreak Island to take on water and fresh vegetables had made the ultimate sacrifice. The vegetables, which had been purchased at the same time, were mostly gone, but the hens were laying well enough to provide mayonnaise, and Valaine had contrived a potato salad, heavy on pickles and onions and short on celery and bell pepper, unfortunately, but still tasty, to accompany the roasted rice-stuffed wyverns. Fresh-baked bread and butter, which alas had been somewhat less fresh than the bread, and spiced bread pudding had completed the menu. Now the Admiral lit his pipe and waited patiently while everyone but young Master Sverzman, Dancer's signal midshipman, followed his example. Once all pipes were drawing nicely, Manthir cocked an eyebrow at Marshal Grazale.
"And now that the evening's serious business is out of the way, Commander," he said around his pipe stem, "suppose you tell us how your mission ashore went."
"Of course, sir," Grazale straightened and cleared his throat. "As you instructed, I carried your message to Claw Keep." He grimaced.
Calling it a keep is a definite overstatement, in my opinion, Sir Gwilym. It does have a curtain wall, but I imagine we could knock it down with a 14-pounder in an afternoon. And there's no real keep at all, just a couple of dozen buildings, mostly houses of a sort, but at least three saloons, sort of huddled together inside the wall.
Not too surprising, sir, Captain Rafe McGale put in.
Manthir's flag captain was a wiry, black-haired man with extremely dark brown eyes. He was 8 years younger than his admiral, and his promotion to captain's rank was relatively recent. There was a lot of that going around, but he'd been at sea since he was 12, and there was very little he hadn't seen.
That curtain wall of marshals would be intended to discourage pirates, or other pirates, I should say, rather than provide any serious defense.
The flag captain sniffed disdainfully.
I may not think much of the Harchongese Navy, but if these people were ever foolish enough to make themselves a serious nuisance to the Empire, all the walls in the world wouldn't save their asses, and they know it.
That was my impression, Captain, Grazael agreed with a nod. And, Admiral, he returned his gaze to Manthir, they've got a lot of fishing boats for such a small town. Some of them are damn near as big as Messenger, too. And they've got brackets for swivel wolves. Captain Lafat, he's the fellow in charge, seemed just a bit eager to keep me from noticing that little detail.
Point taken, Master Grazael, Manthir said.
Wolf was a generic term for artillery pieces with a bore of less than 2 inches and a shot which weighed 1 pound or less. Swivel wolves were at the small end of the range. Whether they were very light cannon or extremely heavy muskets was mostly a matter of semantics. They had little effect on the hull of a ship, but they were portable, easily mounted on a ship's rail, or dismounted and hidden when a cruiser came along, and effective anti-personnel weapons, just the thing for a crew of pirates who wanted to swarm over a lightly manned, weakly armed merchant vessel.
So your impression is that this Lafat, was it, might occasionally fish for something besides forktail or hake, he went on,
and Grazael nodded again.
I'd say that's exactly what he does, sir, the lieutenant commander replied. Mind you, from the look of things, it doesn't seem to pay very well.
Manthir snorted. He'd never yet met a pirate who couldn't have earned more over the long run doing honest work, not to mention living longer into the bargain.
And I don't doubt for a moment that Captain Lafat's rank was entirely self-bestowed. I couldn't decide where he's from originally, but I'm pretty sure he's not Harchongese. He's too tall, among other things, and I don't think he's at all pleased with the notion of having us move in.
Now I wonder why that might be,
Yeoman Seasmoke, Dancer's first lieutenant, murmured, earning an even harsher snort from his admiral.
Should I assume from that he told you to pound sand, Commander?
Manthir asked dryly, and Grazael laughed.
I think that's exactly what he wished he could do, sir. Unfortunately, one of those fishing boats of his apparently got a fairly accurate count on the squadron before it ran for harbor. I don't think he thinks all those transports are empty.
This time, a general mutter of laughter ran around the dining table.
Lafat, if that's even his real name, has obviously decided he doesn't want to lock horns with you, Sir Gwilym,
Grazael continued.
He tried to argue that the island's wells don't produce enough water to support this many extra mouths. I think he's exaggerating his concerns, but I don't think he's making them up entirely either. In the end, though, he agreed to open his gates to us. I imagine everyone in Claw Keep is busy hiding evidence before the Marines come ashore.
I imagine that's exactly what they're doing, Manthir agreed. Well, that and trying to get a messenger out to report us to the governor of Quiraz, or maybe Teagle Camp, depending on the wind. I suppose he promised faithfully that no such action would ever so much as cross his mind, Commander.
Something of that sort, sir, yes.
Good. Manthir smiled nastily. It's not as if the Harchongese aren't going to figure out we're here pretty damned quick, if they didn't already guess this was where we were headed. But when the good captain's messenger runs into Lance lying in the middle of North Channel, it'll give me a little more leverage with him, or a bigger club to beat him with, at any rate. The Admiral considered for several moments, then nodded to himself.
You did well, Master Grisail, he said. I'll see to it that my reports indicate as much.
The young Chisomian smiled with obvious pleasure, but said nothing, and Manthir returned to his flag captain.
With any luck, we'll have a south or southeast wind tomorrow morning, Rafe. Assuming we've got one we can work with, I want the entire fleet inside Hardship Bay by evening. I doubt Captain LeFat is stupid enough to try anything foolish, but let's not take any chances. We'll use a couple of the schooners to lead the squadron, and tell Brigadier Teotain that I want two or three companies of his marines to go ashore and secure the keep before we anchor.
Yes, sir.
In that case, gentlemen, the Admiral said, reaching for the whiskey decanter, I think we can safely lift a glass to a job well done by Commander Grisail.
3. HMS Dancer 56, off Trove Island, Gulf of Dolar. Green, Sir Gwilym Manthir thought, was a remarkably nice color. It was particularly nice after spending 2 entire 5 days on rocky, barren, sun-blasted, thoroughly miserable Claw Island. The green which prompted that particular consideration was found in the trees and grass covering Trove Island off the Dolar Bank. Technically, the island's inhabitants, of which thankfully there were not many, were subjects of King Ronald of Dolar. Trove Island, however, did not belong to King Ronald. Emperor Waisu VI's ministers had made that point abundantly clear. Actually, the present emperor's father, who had also happened to be named Waisu, had made it clear to King Ronald's father, who had also happened to be named Ronald, and the current Waisu had simply expressed his intention to keep things that way. The current Ronald didn't much care for it, since he had pretensions of extending Dolaran sway throughout the entire Gulf of Dolar. Despite the money he'd poured into the fleet, which had been destroyed at Rock Point and Crag Reach, however, he'd never had the military strength to survive a serious disagreement with Harchong. It was admittedly unlikely Harchong would put itself to the trouble and expense of squashing Dolaran posturing, but unlikely wasn't the same thing as never going to happen, and provoking Harchong to military action was the sort of mistake one normally only got to make once. On the other hand, he'd managed to get Harchong to agree that the Dolar Bank and the islands around Whale Island Shoal farther west would be unclaimed by either realm. Waisu, or rather his ministers, it was entirely possible Waisu hadn't made a single policy-making decision during his entire 12 years on the throne, hadn't cared enough to argue. All they'd wanted was to make certain Dolar didn't fortify any of the island's harbors and that Ronald's expansionist ambitions were held more or less in check. Well, they'd also wanted to be sure the lucrative smuggling traffic, which passed through the islands and deposited sizable sums in their purses, continued unabated, of course. Manthir had been pleasantly surprised to discover that the state of affairs continued unchanged. He'd expected the Dolarans and Harchongese to have patched up some sort of understanding, now that the group of four had more or less married them at sword point. From a Carizian perspective, leaving nice, convenient island bases less than 500 miles off the coast of Dolar, and even closer than that to Harchong's province of Erek, wide open to enemy occupation, was an act of lunacy. It would no more have occurred to Emperor Caleb to do such a thing than it would have occurred to him to go swimming with krakens with a fresh stake tied to his back. If anything had been wanting to convince Manthir that neither Dolarans nor Harchongese had even the ghost of a whisper of a clue where the realities of naval strategy were concerned,
Finding these islands completely unfortified and unprotected provided it. He watched boatloads of Marines pulling for the shore and shook his head. Disgusted as he was also grateful. Kelm Bay, on Trove's northeastern coast, was too small for his entire force. It measured barely 8 miles in width, and it was totally open to any northerly wind, but the water was relatively deep, the bottom was good holding ground, and it was practically impervious to wind from any other direction, thanks to the island's rocky height. As a temporary anchorage for minor repairs or resupply, it would do very well indeed. And it was the island's only really good deep-water anchorage. So, once Major Brainock Windale's battalion of Colonel Vasag Pariah's 14th Marine Regiment was ensconced ashore, taking the island back again would present a major military challenge. Especially with the battery of 30-pounders, which had been thoughtfully brought along, specifically to make King Renald's and Emperor Waisu's lives difficult. He was just as happy Kelmsport, the island's largest town, had less than 200 inhabitants. It decreased the probability of anyone's doing anything foolish, although he couldn't quite rule the possibility out, especially with the religious component to consider. Still, it seemed unlikely, and Kelmsport had reliable sources of water, which was always the greatest potential weakness of a warship. Assuming the locals were inclined to be reasonable, it might also be another source of fresh food, which wasn't anything to sneeze at. Brigadier Teotain's 5th Brigade and the 2nd Battalion of Colonel Pariah's Independent Regiment had laboriously broken ground for crops back at Claw Island, and the water supply there was nowhere near as limited as Captain Lafat had suggested. It had taken quite a bit of ingenuity to rig an aqueduct and a wind-powered pump to feed it to provide adequate irrigation. But one thing the island had in plenty was seabird and wyvern guano. That provided lots of fertilizer, and at least half Teotain's Marines had been farm boys before they enlisted. Still, it would be an arduous task to grow enough food for the expedition. He expected to get at least some supplies from the prizes he was shortly going to be taking, but having an additional source would be more than simply convenient. "And if the Trove Islanders will sell us food, then we can probably convince the other islands in the area to do the same thing, if we're willing to be discreet about it. Another thing the naval geniuses who left them wide open this way obviously didn't consider." He shook his head wonderingly one more time over his opponent's stupidity, then turned away from the rail. It was time he and his captains got down to the business of making the other side's lives as miserable as possible. "And it serves the idiots right, too," he thought.